from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rocketed to a record high this week, the highest since the recession. Is this a sign that our economy is recovering, or is it just a short-term spike? We'll talk about what this means for the economy, market growth, jobs, housing, and the road ahead. Our guests include Kathleen Pender, business columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, Peter Coy, economics editor for Bloomberg Businessweek, and Scott Anderson, senior vice president and chief economist for Bank of the West. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. The Dow has been rising almost nonstop this year and closed yesterday at over 14,253, eclipsing a previous high of 14,164 back on the 9th of October in 2007. And it shot up 51 points today and it seems to be continuing to move up. So what are these high skyrocketing market numbers tell us, and how separate are they from what is often described as the real economy? We want to take that and more up in this forum hour as we take on the subject of the economy and these high stock market numbers. Excuse me. Joining us this morning is Peter Coy, who's economics editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He joins us from New York City. Good morning, Peter Coy.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Good, and good to have you with us. Also good to have Kathleen Pender here in studio, business columnist, Net Worth with San Francisco Chronicle. Good morning, Kathleen.
Good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to Scott Anderson, who is here with us, senior vice president and chief economist of the Bank of the West. Good morning, Scott.
Good morning.
Now that I say good morning, everybody, Peter Coy, let me go to you and let's talk about what seems to be at least compelling these big numbers that are being registered on the stock market. A lot of it seems to have to do with, high corporate profits.
That's right. So you asked in your introduction the right question, which is, what's the connection between the stock market and the real economy? And there is a connection, of course. Remembering what drives the stock market is the expectation of corporate profits, because that's what people want. They want to get either dividends paid out, you know, that's what companies do when they have a lot of profits, or profits reinvested for the growth of the company so that they'll be able to get their dividends out later. Anyway, so it basically all comes down to profits, but there's a disconnect between corporate profits and the real economy right now. The share of corporate profits as a piece of the national income is near record highs. Meanwhile, the share of labor compensation is unusually low. So at the same time, and that's only looking at the U.S. economy, a big part of corporate profits come from S&P 500 companies that do business abroad. And there are some healthier markets abroad, China being an obvious example. So even if the U.S. is not doing particularly well, the companies with headquarters here, the big names, Coca-Cola's and so on of the world, can still be doing nicely.
Yeah, a lot of money is being made with those better economies overseas. And investors don't bite their nails or worry about unemployment, do they?
Right. Well, you know, they may care about it in their personal lives, but it's not going to determine their investment decisions. And, you know, it shouldn't. If, you know, you can care a lot about unemployment, but say, nevertheless, I think stocks are fairly valued at these levels. And we can get into later what the market's telling us about the valuation of stocks. I happen to think that although there are certainly problems ahead, that stock prices are not unusually high by historical standards relative to profits.
Well, corporate profits are high, though, and the economic growth is low. So how much of this has to do with free money coming from the Fed?
Oh, well, okay. Then you just moved on to the next important issue, which is a lot. The answer is yes, a lot of it has to do, because think about it. As an investor, you really have two big choices, stocks or bonds. And when bond prices are very high, it sort of discourages you from going into the bond market as you look more seriously at stocks. Bond prices now are extremely high, which is another way of saying interest rates are extremely low. There's because they move in opposite directions. You know, the Fed has maintained the federal funds rate, the short-term interest rate that it controls, at 0 to 1.25% for a record period of time. I mean, basically, the Fed is treating the economy as if it's on life support, and it's just a truly unusual circumstance. I think people have forgotten how unusual it is. So that drives investors to look elsewhere for yield, and they go to the stock market, and that pushes stock prices up.
Again, Peter Coy with us from New York is economics editor of Bloomberg Business Week, and Kathleen Pender here in studio is business columnist, net worth with the San Francisco Chronicle. Are there better market indicators, Kathleen, than the Dow? I mean, NASDAQ or particularly S&P, industrials essentially are what the Dow is all about.
Well, the Dow, of course, is only 30 stocks. The Standard & Poor's, obviously, 500 stocks. The S&P is just a hair below its all-time high as well. It's a little broader. It has more technology companies, greater weighting in financials, and those stocks haven't done quite as well as the Dow, which is one reason it's lagging a bit. The NASDAQ, of course, is full of all our local tech stocks, Apple, Google, et cetera, et cetera. It's way below the high it set in 2000, which is kind of a reminder of, you know, bubbles and manias, and it can take a long time to recover from something like we had in 2000, the tech boom.
Well, a lot of what we're hearing now is the word bubble once again with these all-time highs, especially coming after the sequester and coming after all the talk about fiscal cliff and how the economy isn't moving forward. I guess it's a kind of axiomatic, isn't it, that the market just hates uncertainty?
Well, I don't think it's – I'm not really hearing that it's a bubble right now. Yes, it's hitting a new high, but the previous high was almost 5 years ago. So on the one hand, you could say, yeah, stocks are high. But on the other hand, you could say, shoot, if I've been in the Dow for 5 years, I'm just back where I was 5 years ago. And after inflation, you've kind of lost money.
Except I remember the last time the stock market seemed headed for records was followed by some pretty difficult times.
Well, that's a big question now. Are we heading into an 08 or are we actually getting more on a path to recovery long term?
A lot of other big questions. I mean, we've reduced the deficit. Is there a likelihood of more credit downgrades?
Credit downgrades?
Well, like we saw with S&P.
Oh, of the U.S. debt?
Yeah. You're turning towards Scott here.
I was going to say, that's a good question for Scott.
What do you think, Scott?
Well, there's certainly still a risk out there. We're making some progress in our debt and deficits as a share of our economy, but the sequester may bring us a little bit closer to that, but with the risk of that, it'll slow our economy down. So there's more work to do. Most economists think we need at least another $1.3 trillion in spending or tax increases to get us to a stable debt situation. So Fitch said they're kind of affirming our credit rating at this point, but they want to see more action from Congress this year.
And companies have picked up their spending plans despite the sequester, though, haven't they?
They have. That's kind of the surprise, I think. A lot of people thought that the sequester and the uncertainty around government spending cuts would lead to a slowdown in business spending. What it seems to have happened is after January 1st, we got past the fiscal cliff without the sky falling. Businesses actually went ahead with some of their spending plans. We got real good durable goods order numbers. In January, we've seen a very strong uptick in ISM manufacturing and non-manufacturing surveys around new orders.
Also in home sales since January.
And home sales have been very strong. So the consumer has held in there, at least in terms of the housing market. New home sales were up almost 16% in January alone. Auto sales at 15.3 million units is back to pre-recession levels. So the durable sector certainly being supported by the low interest rate environment, the Fed has helped.
And despite some 775,000 jobs that will be lost with sequester, I'm looking at right off the wire here, the number of Americans who file for unemployment benefits declined to a six-week low, showing further improvement in the labor market. And that suggests that maybe you said the sky is falling. Maybe we've heard too much henny-penny talk here.
Well, it does appear that layoffs are down. So jobless claims are five-year lows right now. So we are seeing some reduction in layoffs. One thing that's changed is productivity growth has slowed down a lot. So in order for businesses to keep up with demand, they have to hire more workers. And so we're seeing a little bit of that activity, though I don't think the hiring is as strong as the jobless claims numbers make it out to be. And we'll see on Friday when you get the new payroll numbers. But we're still seeing moderate job creation at best.
What do you expect for Friday?
We're looking for about 150,000 jobs in the month, which is a little bit below the consensus. So not enough to move the unemployment rate down. We still think it'll be at 7.9%. So Yeah, we're making progress. We're continuing to create jobs. The worst case scenario didn't play out in January, but we have the sequester still going to be kicking in, and I think it'll have more of an effect on the data come April, May, and June. So we'll see more impacts in the second quarter.
And I want to actually talk with Peter Coy because he's done some analysis of the effects of the sequester. But let me go back to you first, Kathleen Pender. What about the effect of all this on the budget deadline, March 27th?
Well, the House yesterday passed a continuing resolution that will allow the government to keep operating after March 27th. I guess the next big deadline will come in May when we have to raise the debt ceiling again. But I think that there might be maybe some thawing in Washington between this very partisan politics that kept government from really doing anything productive. So it'll be interesting to see what happens on that going forward. But I think maybe Washington will be somewhat less of a story for the next couple months, and people will be focusing more on the real economy.
And beyond then, when we have to raise the federal debt ceiling by May 18th, I believe it is?
I can't predict what's going to happen then, but that'll be the next big deadline, I think.
Well, Peter Coy, let me go back to the sequester with you, because you've been talking about this to some extent as a bubble, I believe, especially with concern about border crossings on the economy and about delays with the FAA, which we've certainly heard a lot about. Also, food inspectors. I mean, put this into perspective for us in terms of what you think the sequester is really going to do or the impact it's going to have.
So when most people look at the impact of the sequestration, they treat it like any other budget cut. Say there are certain computer models that say, okay, you reduce government spending by this much, you know, turn the handle on your model and pop out what's going to happen to GDP and jobs. And the Congressional Budget Office, which is nonpartisan, did that exercise and came up with an estimate that there'd be 750,000 fewer jobs by the end of this year and an economy that's 0.6 percentage points, a little less than 1%, smaller than it would have been otherwise. Not good, of course, especially because that's only an increment on the declines we already have from other sorts of austerity. You remember the payroll tax going up and so on. But actually, I think it could be worse than that, potentially anyway, because the computer models haven't taken into account the bottleneck effect. You mentioned the FAA as being one. The Department of Homeland Security is another. And as you go down the list, you start to realize that very small budget cuts could have very big ripple effects if they prevent people from carrying out business as usual. Perfect example would be if there aren't enough inspectors to bring food in, that food doesn't arrive at the factories where it gets processed. If you at a given plant in the U.S., meat packing plants, for example, they're not allowed to send meat out without it having been inspected. If the USDA is required to put inspectors on furlough and it was not overstaffed to begin with, you could have a bottleneck there. And these bottlenecks could propagate through the economy. I spoke to an expert in logistics at MIT, Yossi Sheffi, who said that he doesn't predict this kind of problem that I'm talking about, but he said if it does happen, it could happen very non-linearly, very fast. So I just think it's something we should really be keeping an eye on and not assuming that it's just going to be business as usual through this sequestration.
And again, Peter Coy with us from New York is economics editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Scott Anderson, Scott Anderson, senior vice president and chief economist of Bank of the West. Let's get back to these numbers from the stock market. If you adjust them for inflation, the numbers of the Dow are still actually below the 2000 level. I think that has to be factored in here and understood by people. But I also noticed, because we're talking about profit driving this, corporate profit driving this, it used to be with Wells Fargo, and Wells Fargo has 2/3 of its profits from trading derivatives.
Well, yeah, profits are picking up. One thing Peter mentioned is, you know, corporate profits as a share of the economy are at the highest levels they've ever been, but profitability growth is slowing down. And that's, I think, what the stock market should start to be focusing on. One thing I've noticed as the stock market has taken off since January 1st, I think we're up almost 9% year to date now, and most of the indicators. stock analysts on Wall Street have actually been cutting their earnings growth estimates for the first quarter. It started out at a 2.2% growth rate. January 1st, it's now down to a negative 0.4% estimate. And 77% of the companies that have pre-announced guidance for the first quarter have issued negative guidance, which is a lot higher than historical averages. So I'd be a little careful treading into these record high levels, especially if you're sitting on a lot of money in cash right now and you're thinking, well, should I jump into the markets at these levels? I don't think we've seen all the impacts from the sequester yet. I agree with Peter. And I think a lot of companies, that at least the ones I've talked to, assume that sequester wouldn't happen. So when there's an unexpected event like that, there could be some impacts. One thing I saw this morning, Challenger Gray and Christmas, the company that issues a report around layoffs, suggested that layoffs are on the rise for the latest month. So again, I don't think we've seen all the impacts from sequester yet, and some of this celebrating on Wall Street might be a little premature.
Well, there is celebration. In fact, some of these bulls are telling us that the Dow may break 20,000 in a few years. We're hearing that kind of prediction. Let's not jump the gun here too much. Incidentally, let me also invite those of you listening to join this conversation. I want to do that now because I know when we're talking about the economy and we're talking about the stock market, particularly as it continues to move upward, at least for the present, many of you have some thoughts and some questions and comments, and so bring them to the fore here. Our toll-free number is available right now, and you can call us now, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. We welcome your phone calls. It's toll-free, 866-733-6786. Again, the number for your calls, and you can call us now, is 866-733-6786. And, of course, there are other ways to communicate with us. If you have questions or comments or want to join the conversation, you can email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, which is kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also go to our Facebook page or tweet us, our Twitter handle at KQED Forum. And Kathleen Pender, we were talking about big questions before, and one of the big questions, maybe the next big question, is how we can get to some kind of normal monetary policy.
Well, that is the big question that I think a lot of market analysts, investors are going to move a little bit away from focusing on fiscal policy, what Congress is doing, and focus really much more on what the Fed is doing and how they're going to reverse this huge and unprecedented monetary stimulus they've been undertaking for the last few years. They've been buying billions and billions of dollars of government bonds and mortgage-backed bonds in an effort to keep interest rates down. And if we do have a pickup in the economy or a pickup in inflation, people are very concerned about how the Fed is going to be able to unwind this position and what impacts that's going to have on the market, on the economy. And I think you're going to see the focus already is shifting toward what is the Fed going to do and what impact will that have.
So, Peter Coy, as you indicated earlier, we have to detach this, really, the real economy from what's going on in the market and see them as separate.
Yeah, you know, there's an old expression on Wall Street, don't fight the Fed. And the latest jump in the stock market indices, I think, has a lot to do with not fighting the Fed, recognizing that Ben Bernanke is still in the driver's seat. There's some of the hawks on the Federal Open Market Committee are speaking out more about concern about the possibility of inflation. But Bernanke and his vice chair, Janet Yellen, of course, from San Francisco there, are clearly still in charge and have the votes they need to keep pushing a very dovish policy. Bernanke gave a speech at the San Francisco Fed on March 1st, in which he justified and the low rates and the bond buying that the Fed has pursued almost even more explicitly than it has in the past. And I think that was like putting a marker down saying, folks, we're sticking with this. Don't test our resolve. We're in this for the long haul.
The low yields on the bond market are a big part of this whole thing, aren't they, Scott Anderson?
Exactly.
Yeah. Let me go to a caller here. Ravi, join us. First caller joining us from the South Bay. Hi.
Hi. Am I on air?
Yeah, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call. My question for your experts was a lot of the technology companies right now have a lot of cash sitting in foreign accounts. I was wondering if your experts could comment on how these companies should bring it back to the U.S. and how it's affecting the valuation of these stocks. Thank you.
Well, one way is to change our tax structure, but far be it from me to make such a suggestion. Some thoughts on that, perhaps, from you, Scott Anderson?
Well, that's right. I think the if you look at the U.S. Commerce organizations, they certainly want lower tax structures. So a lot of companies are saying we're sitting on a lot of cash overseas that needs to be – we'd like to bring it back home, but we are not going to do that with the current tax situation. So I think it's kind of a political question. Obviously, the government wants to get their tax revenues, so cutting those taxes, but it could be a problem. But I think there's certainly some economic benefits that could come out of that. Could help boost business investment. Could add some more jobs here in the United States. But it's I've seen analysis on both sides of the equation.
Kathleen Pender, you have something to add here?
Well, the government several years ago let companies bring back those quote-unquote overseas profits at a much reduced tax rate. And the companies all promised that if you let us do this, we'll bring it back and we'll hire people, we'll build plants, blah, blah, blah. And, there's a lot of evidence that they didn't. They brought it back and they paid dividends to shareholders, which is not necessarily a bad thing. But I think all these companies are waiting around for the government to do that again. I think they set a bad precedent. And whether they're, unless they put some sort of I think it's hard to say we'll only let you bring it back at a reduced rate if you promise to hire people, because money's fungible and there's no guarantee that that's how they're going to use it. But that's another question for Congress. One of many, many tax questions they're going to have to grapple with over the next year.
And Ravi, I thank you for the call. I want to go to another caller. John, hi, you're on.
Hi there. So doesn't the Fed purchase basically a constant amount of government debt? And so if the government is not borrowing that money, aren't they going to be buying that debt from the public and therefore putting that money into the private economy, thus stimulating the private economy more than if the government spent that money?
Yeah, Peter Coy.
Not positive I followed the question. The Fed is buying a constant supply of bonds, and it's also anytime stuff that matures, it reinvests that money into more bonds. So, yeah, the issue is always what is the transmission effect from those bond purchases into the real economy. One critical difference, and this is what Ben Bernanke keeps coming back to, is you can't look at this the way you would look at a time when the economy was at full employment. Deficit spending is a big mistake when you have a fully employed economy, because then the government is taking resources away from the private sector. But when the private sector is underemployed, when you have idle resources, suddenly it makes a lot more sense to have the government do something with the money, preferably, of course, something productive. A great example is building bridges, repairing roads. That's fiscal policy. That's not under the purview of the Fed. The Fed is stuck with the only tools it has, which is monetary policy. That's pushing down interest rates across the yield curve from very short to very long. And it's doing what it can. It may not be everything. In fact, it's not everything. Ben Bernanke is the first one to say, hey, we over here at the Fed can only do so much. It's basically pleading with Congress to do something more on the fiscal side to stimulate economic growth.
All right, we're coming up on a break. And again, I want to give out the phone number if you'd like to join us. If you have thoughts about the skyrocketing market or about the economy or questions, you can join us toll free at 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our focus this hour is on the economy. In light of the Dow Jones Industrial Average rocketing to a record high this week, and it's the highest since the recession, and really the question we're putting before you is this a sign our economy is recovering, and what are your thoughts about it? Or maybe it's just a short-term spike. We're hearing from experts here, and we're talking about what this means for the economy and also having to put into the whole equation, market growth and jobs and housing and really the world ahead. With us in studio is Scott Anderson, who's Senior Vice President and Chief Economist of the Bank of the West, and also Kathleen Pender, business columnist with Net Worth on the, from the San Francisco Chronicle. And with us by phone, Peter Coy, who's in New York City, economics editor of Bloomberg Business Week. And again, you can join us, toll-free number 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum at kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Let me go to a caller first, and we'll get some of your emails on here. And William from Belvedere joins us. William, good morning.
Yes, thank you very much. I have a relatively straightforward question. I'd like to know whether the guests consider that the fact that the banks can borrow money from the Federal Reserve at, I believe, it's less than 1%, and then through credit cards they are lending out that money at 15 or 20%, would constitute, they believe, on behalf of the Federal Reserve, a subsidy for the banks.
Well, Scott Anderson, this goes to you.
Well, the Federal Reserve pays interest on reserves. The banks are now have about $1 trillion in reserves at the Federal Reserve. This is the money that the Fed has been pumping into the banking system through their quantitative asset purchases. They pay the banks about a quarter percentage point for those reserves. Now, this is money that the banks could loan out as new auto loans, new car loans, new mortgages. But it's been slow to come out of the taps. And the reason, you know, banks state is that the loan demand is weak. We're just not seeing the demand for loans that we're in. We want to loan to good credits, but the pickings are slim. And so they have been making new loans, and we're seeing credit growth now really for the first time since the financial crisis hit. You know, that's what the banking business is. Basically, they collect deposits, pay out lower interest rates, and they make loans and credit card offers at higher interest rates. And the difference is the net interest margin. And that's what the banks live on. That's their profitability. And there's no doubt about with the Fed lowering rates that that's in the past has boosted bank profitability over the past 2 or 3 years. But what now banks are worried about is that the yield curve is so flat, the long end of the curve is so flat that the spreads on mortgages over their cost of funds is actually very, very low. So bank profitability has actually been squeezed by the Fed's programs recently. And banks are struggling, and that's why you're seeing the banks hold back on hiring a lot more than you're seeing in other industries, because you're not seeing the profitability in the banking industry we had prior to the crisis.
I thank the caller, and let me go to an email here. Listener named Bonnie writes, please ask your guests to comment on how record high levels in the stock market, the sequester, and the Fed's likely reaction will affect home mortgage rates for the coming weeks and months. You want to tackle that, Kathleen?
Well, the Fed has promised to do everything in its power, which is substantial, to keep long-term interest rates low until unemployment drops to a certain level. And I think you can take them at their word, which would mean that to the extent that home mortgage rates follow Treasury bond rates, you could expect low mortgage rates for quite a while.
Here's a listener, and let me go to you on this, Peter Coy. Kathy, who writes on our website, has the recent larger company mergers, Office Depot, Office Max, American U.S. Airways, had much impact? And if so, how long will that last?
Depends on what we're talking about for impact. The most obvious impact for consumers would be how it affects their daily lives, which would be a combination of supposedly the greater efficiencies and variety you might get from a stronger combined company versus the downside of less choice and possibly higher prices. That's not so much a macroeconomic effect, the kind we've been talking about. It's more of a microeconomic effect, you know, but it's still important.
And since you mentioned micro effects, I'm looking at an email from a listener who writes, The Economist reports 95% of GDP growth in the U.S. since the financial crisis is flowing to the top 0.2%. Can you discuss and explain why and what macro changes could occur to shift some benefit of growth to the rest of us? Peter Coy?
It's an excellent question, and it's one that the Fed also has looked at. It doesn't seem like something that the Federal Reserve, the central bank, would be interested in, but they've given a lot of attention to the problem of inequality. One straightforward effect is that the rich people don't spend a lot of money when they make more money. They tend, because they have so much to start with, that any incremental money they come in makes very little difference to them. Whereas, so for example, a tax cut for the rich does not have a big effect on spending. And whereas if you give a tax cut to the poor, or if you raise the payroll tax back to where it used to be, as we just did in January, that has a marked, noticeable effect on spending at the low end. So at a time when the economy is slow, that kind of spending matters. The supply side argument is, well, that may all be true, but what we really care about is giving the people with a lot of money more incentive to invest, and if we, and that'll result in more supply, more wealth in the long term, and that's the critical issue.
Peter Coy with us from New York, economics editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. And here's Joe in Santa Clara, Scott Anderson, who says, so far, conversation seems to confirm my belief that the system is being gamed. First, the commentators seem to continue to equate the economy to the stock market, yet they initially stated that currently the nation's economy and the stock market are disjointed. Second, it was stated that the stock market is driven by corporate profits, and current corporate profits seem to be largely based on foreign holdings and the free money from the Fed. Isn't the Fed then giving the rich, who are the major players in the stock market, an unfair advantage in the U.S. economy?
Well, I think the Fed's position on their monetary easing is that they need to boost growth. If we get stronger GDP growth, we'll get stronger demand, we'll get more people employed, and that's going to push some of these benefits down to the lower income classes. Part of the reason why we haven't seen the benefits of this expansion spread across a wider swath of the population is that we haven't had enough growth. We haven't had enough demand.
We're not talking about trickle-down economics here, are we?
No, I think we're talking about aggregate. This is pure Keynesianism, right, or the general theory, Keynes. You got to boost aggregate demand to an extent that you're going to get some job creation out of this, and that's going to help us help the lower classes boost their economic fortunes and standard of living. But it's also going to help out on the debt side for the U.S. government because we'll have better tax revenues. We'll have less costs in terms of unemployment benefits. So it's a win-win for everybody. So if the Fed can be successful in getting the growth rate up, into the 3% range for a while, at least that would go a long way towards getting our economy and our financial situation back on track.
Except I know we may be at a crisis fatigue state here. In fact, I think, Kathleen, you've written about this. But the fact of the matter is that all the predictions with respect to sequester are growth at a minimum.
Well, I think, yeah, I was writing about crisis fatigue because it just so happened that the Dow hit a record high just a couple days after the sequester took effect. So I think people are just somewhat tired of all these crises that we've been facing, most of which never really materialized. And I think there is a change in sentiment happening. For the last, ever since the housing crisis, the financial crisis, individual investors have just been completely hiding out in cash and the bond market, very safe investments. They've been very reluctant to put anything into any risky assets like the stock market. They've pulled about $400 billion out of stock funds. They've put about $1 billion into stock funds, into bond funds, rather, since the end of 07. And you're just now starting to see them tiptoe back into the stock market. Mutual fund flows into stock funds in the first 2 months of the year were positive for the first time. And I think that there's just this fatigue over things like the sequester and the indecision going on in Washington, and people are maybe just starting to think that there are good things going on in the economy. Housing's recovering. People are seeing their houses in their neighborhood snapped up. Unemployment's coming down slowly, but at least it's not going up anymore. And I think there's a bit of a change in sentiment. I think that's a lot what's happening in the market this year, is that you're just starting to see maybe, you know, light at the end of the tunnel, or that maybe the era of crises is coming to an end.
And maybe the bulls are on the run. Huh? Well, here's a listener, actually, who raises an interesting question, and perhaps, Kathleen, you'd like to respond. Daniel, who says, the Dow has just recently been sold to a new buyer who has access exclusively to their computers. What do you think? Is the Dow being manipulated?
I don't know what he's talking about.
Yeah, I don't think the Dow is being manipulated.
Well, does the change in ownership mean anything? Or does that bode anything?
Well, you can certainly boost stock prices if you have more buyers than sellers.
Yeah.
And so you can bid up prices, no doubt about it. And that's partly what's going on right now. And the fact that prices are going up when earnings estimates and growth rates are going down suggests that the P.E. ratios on stocks are going up, which means that they're more expensive overall. Basically, investors are willing to pay more to hold that stock at the same earnings level. So it really means that stocks are becoming more expensive because they're more in demand.
Well, the S&P 500 is also very close to a record high. And, you know, I don't think who's ever manipulating the Dow is also manipulating the S&P. I don't think there's a lot to that.
There is some manipulation because the Fed's trying to force investors into these riskier assets. I mean, they're making the returns on cash. And, you know, if you looked at your interest rates on your money market funds lately, they're almost zero. And that's pushing investors to look at alternatives. How long can you sit on cash earning no return? People got to retire. They want to make money for their long-term in retirements. They're going to have to put it somewhere. And so you're starting to see people dabble in housing and real estate and in stocks as a consequence.
I'm going to go to more of your calls here, but a question from a listener, Peter Coy, Chris, who says, so many of us buy stock through monthly 401k retirement plans. If someone puts X amount, yes, XXX amount, in every month for the past 15 years adjusted for inflation, would that person be ahead, behind, or even? Basic question, but I can't find any answer to it.
Obviously, it depends on your time horizon. Overall, the stock market has been extremely disappointing ever since the 2000, it hit a huge spike there that we're still talking about. That was a dot-com bubble, which had a lot to do with you guys out there in San Francisco. I'm not blaming you. But
yes, you are.
The P.E. of the S&P 500, and that's not even the NASDAQ, which is far more tech-heavy, reached around 30. And that means the prices were 30 times earnings per share. And now it's down around 13 or 14. So you see, we got really frothy. To answer the caller's question, the smart thing to do is do exactly what he or she is doing, which is to invest a little bit every month out of your paycheck, keep the blindfold on, and stick in there for the long term, because the chance that you're going to outsmart the market and know exactly when to buy and when to sell to miss the peaks and valleys is extremely small. Better off just, now, I mean, perhaps you might have wanted to take some money off the table back in the dot-com bubble 1999, 2000, but now is certainly a relatively good time to be in the market.
And let's bring more of our callers on. Michael, join us. Welcome.
Good morning. I served on the Bond Oversight Committee for the City of Sacramento's school district, and we did an investigation on how the cost structure worked out between purchasing infrastructure for schools or other government, I think by extrapolation, compared to the private sector. And what we saw was that it was about, for a whole bunch of reasons, it was about 9 or 10 times what the going commercial rate was for the same objects where we could get direct comparisons. Doesn't that sort of insider's game, parasite welfare, whatever you want to call it, doesn't that really dampen the Keynesian effect of getting more people to work? If we're trying to say we want to spend money on infrastructure, that's great, but don't we first have to attack this really bloated acquisition structure to see that it actually translates into jobs?
Well,
I'd rather see three people hired at $24 an hour than one person at $72.
Yeah, Scott Anderson, you were the Keynesian in residence here, so your thoughts?
I'm not sure I understand the question, but basically Keynes is it's very simple. We're in a situation since the end of the financial crisis where the private sector has not been able to generate enough aggregate demand. Now, we're getting to the point where I think the private sector is almost ready to pull its own weight here. But now we have the drag of the federal government and the belt tightening that needs to happen in government around the decline in tax revenues. So I think this drag will continue for some time because of that. But we're working through the crisis. We knew this was going to be a multi-year process. We're now, you know, 6 years, more than 6 years since the start of the housing downturn. You know, most economists think we're not going to be back to full growth, you know, at least fully employed economy until 2016. So we got some work to do there.
So since you're the banker here, speaking about work that needs to be done, there are a lot of people saying we need more bank transparency. In fact, there are some real hue and cry about the need for bank transparency.
Well, I think you're hearing a lot about too big to fail, and some of these institutions, you're hearing some of these hearings up in at the Senate Banking Committee and others about some of these institutions have gotten even bigger throughout the crisis because of failed institutions have been gobbled up by some of the bigger players. Deposits have gotten more concentrated. So there is this sense that we maybe not haven't solved all these problems with the Dodd-Frank bill, and there may be a need to go back and look at, you know, are there other measures we can do to make the banking system more stable financially and structurally?
More of your calls. Gary, join us. Hi.
Hello. Actually, two questions or two topics. One is economic inequality and how that is a drag on our recovery, as well as the long-term prospects for the society where we think people can, everyone can be in the middle class or higher. Number two, I work in healthcare, and I support any change that brings health insurance to more people, and even if it's not perfect. Obamacare is not perfect, but it's something. And how does the lack of universal health insurance have a drag on our economy? So thank you. Number one, inequality. Number two, health insurance coverage.
Thank you for those. We've been talking a lot about economic inequality, and here's a tweet from David who says, the stock rally is an indication that the top 1% are recovering nicely. Let's hear from you, Peter Coy.
I'll take the first person. There's a good connection between the two things, inequality and universal health care. The issue in both cases is what we were talking about a few minutes ago, which is that if you're talking about their impact on the economy, you have to think about both the demand side and the supply side. On the demand side, the problem is that when people don't have money, they can't spend money. So it has a depressive effect on growth. Money that goes to the top does not translate into growth the same way that money to the bottom does. On the supply side, if people are not able to develop their capacities to their full extent because they're too poor or because they're in ill health, then there's a negative supply side effect which slows long-term growth as well. So on both counts, there is an argument to be made for doing more to help the people at the bottom of the income tier.
Peter, let me get your response to a listener's email. He says, bank profits squeezed by long end of lending? Ha! I understand short versus long-term interest rates, but really, get an answer from a non-banker. So let me go to you on this.
Actually, Scott's right that the long-term, the banks and any other investor has fewer profit opportunities now, or smaller profit opportunities when mortgage rates are lower, right? Or the bonds that they invest in are yielding less. They made big profits as the yields fell, but now that they're low levels, it's harder for them to redeploy their money. So the fact that the short-term rates, if you have low short-term rates and high long-term rates, that's perfect for banks. They love that situation. And that's the way it was for a while, and banks were making good money off it and helped them repair their balance sheets after the financial crisis. Now that the Fed has made a concerted effort to bring down long-term rates, and what Scott said is exactly correct, the profit margins have narrowed for banks.
And again, Peter Coy is economics editor of Bloomberg Business Week. Mark from San Francisco writes, people weren't really investing during the downturn, so the government creating incentives to invest won't really help. So what is the right motivation to get people to invest? Kathleen Pender?
Well, I think that maybe it finally is having an effect. As I said before, people are getting back into the market, but people were just shell-shocked. I mean, everyone talks about their 401k is now a 201k, and this was a real, you know, once in a many lifetime event that we had. This was a serious car wreck that's taken a long time to recover from. And people are right. You know, not only did we have that, we had the housing crisis, we had Bernie Madoff in there, throw in a few other scandals. People are right to be, we had the flash crash. There were a lot of things that happened that caused people to be very cautious.
I think you even
takes a long time to recover from that, but I think we are recovering.
You went through the laundry list in your column: bank failures, runs on the U.S. dollar, Treasury securities, AAA rating was lost, 2011 recession, Eurozone breakup, municipal bond defaults. I mean, one after another.
Well, some of these things really happened, and then there were a lot of things that didn't happen. There was the big municipal bond scare where we were going to have all these defaults in the muni bond market. That never happened. But there's been a lot of real and a lot of imagined crises over the last 5 years that have kept people out of the market.
We'll bring another caller on. And Diane, join us.
Hi, thank you very much. I would like to add another point to the fallacy of supply-side economics, which assumes that the extra money that the rich get from their tax cuts, they will stimulate the economy by buying new plant and equipment or investing in new companies. That doesn't happen. They buy stocks and bonds that have bought many, many times before, so there's absolutely zero stimulative effect in the economy by the rich getting richer.
Who would like to respond to Diane? Kathleen Pender.
Well, it's not just people, but companies are sitting on mounds of cash. They're not doing anything with that either. And that could be put to more productive use. At least it could be paid out in dividends. I mean, I think one issue with income inequality, people are so focused on, you know, should we tax people who make more than $250,000 a year? Or should we tax them if they make $400,000 a year? I mean, one of the real drivers of income inequality is that all the middle class jobs, or many of the middle class jobs that used to provide a good living for people, have been outsourced or done away with by technology. And I think what we need to be focusing is how, you know, the long-term structural economy, how do we deal with the loss of these, you know, good-paying middle-class jobs? How do we replace them? I mean, we're having to import a lot of people into Silicon Valley from other countries because they're being trained in the jobs that exist in our country. I think we need to be thinking about the educational system. How do we train people for the jobs that are here now, the jobs of the future, and really focus on that and not, you know, what the tax rate should be on, you know, X amount of income.
In fact, let me just jump on that for a moment and go to you, Peter Coy. I think in your writings, you said that cuts in education and research may have more long-term effects vis-a-vis competition.
Yes. One of the people I spoke to for my article at Tufts University, Bhaskar Chakravorty, was making that point. He's up in Boston, which has been hit by declines under the sequester and research grants from the NIH and NSF. So he's worried about that. He said, you know, he took my point about the bottlenecks we discussed at the beginning of the program, the FAA and so on. But he was more concerned about damage to the fiber of the economy if we're doing less R&D, we're training fewer people to be scientists and engineers.
And we go next to Sherry. Sherry, thanks for waiting. Join us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for this program. My question has to do with the price of metals. I noticed if the stock market is doing so well, the price of metals has only dropped like $100 an ounce since the beginning of the year. What is keeping the price of gold up?
Scott Anderson.
Well, the price of gold has been falling recently from very high levels, but and part of that's due to the I think complacency. We're seeing you know, more optimism about the stock market and the economy in general. The U.S. dollar has been strengthening against other currencies, particularly the Japanese yen, And so that's hurt precious metals and gold. And so we've seen some decline there. A lot of people were holding gold as a safe haven type of an asset. The other thing that people have been holding it for is the risk or hedge against higher inflation from the Fed's monetary policies. And on that front, we're actually, even though gasoline ticked up, gasoline prices retail level ticked up recently, they're starting to come back down again. Oil prices, crude oil prices dropped down to $90 a barrel. So there's less fear about inflation now too. So we're kind of in this sweet spot right now. We're seeing a little bit stronger economic growth, a little bit weaker inflation, and that's caused people to kind of move away from gold, at least for the moment.
Well, here's a listener who writes, I'm a senior on Social Security and a small pension. I have a substantial amount of my assets in fixed income assets. I have seen my income reduced by at least 40% over the last few years. And given the Fed's policy of keeping interest rates low, it seems that I will be using more and more of my principal. Making riskier investments seems to be dangerous at my age. Is anybody thinking about people in my situation? I'd be more than happy to raise my discretionary spending, but not at the expense of my future well-being. Kathleen Bender.
Well, that's the Fed's low interest rate policy has had a de-stimulus effect on people living in fixed incomes because they have less to spend. And that's a real, downside of the Fed's policy. And she is not alone. Anyone living on a fixed income is feeling this way and would love to see higher interest rates. What the Fed's doing is good for borrowers and it's bad for savers.
And apropos of that, listener from Albuquerque, New Mexico, Pedro writes, obviously 401k contributions contribute to increased stock prices. My concern is that once a large portion of 401k participants begin to retire and pull their investment, they'll negatively affect stock prices to a significant extent. Is my concern justified?
Well, there is many people think that as the baby boom retires and takes money out of stocks and puts them into bonds, that could be a long-term impact that could keep bonds up and stocks down, although right now the return you're getting from bonds is very small relative to the risk that you're taking in there. So longer term, I think that is going to happen, but maybe not just right now.
Well, we'll be talking in the next hour, actually, about how to increase longevity through diet other things of that sort. But let me thank Kathleen Pender from the San Francisco Chronicle and Scott Anderson from Bank of the West and Peter Coy from Bloomberg Business Week. Thank you for most enlightening hour. And I want to thank you, our listeners, because we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and appreciate your listenership. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer, Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Executive producer is Raul Ramirez and senior editor Dan Zoll. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.